Rights and Cannabis. Good morning. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Mike Miller, and I'm sitting in this morning for Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, the latest on cannabis and how it could potentially impact next week's Florida primary, as well as the presidential election in general. Our telephone number, if you'd like to join us with questions or comments, is 549-2937. Then later, Cole Pepper will be here, and we'll get a preview of the Players' Championship. All that and more is just ahead. But first, this hour, we're just a little more than a week away from the Florida primary, which takes place Tuesday, March 17th. Early voting, of course, is already underway throughout the First Coast. So we thought we'd take a closer look at where the candidates, as well as President Trump, are when it comes to the cannabis issue. And with the state's regular legislative session scheduled to wrap up this Friday, we also thought we'd take a closer look at where the cannabis-related legislation is expected to end up. Joining us is Sally Peebles, a partner with Vicente Cederberg and a member of the state's Medical Marijuana Advisory Committee. Good morning.
Good morning.
Also, Sheldon Hull is with us, who covers the topic for Folio Weekly. And we're happy to have you with us, too, there. Sheldon. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Okay. What are your questions and comments for them, and how big an issue is this for you in terms of how you plan to vote? Give us a call at 549-2937. Tweet us, email us, or comment on our Facebook page to let us know. Well, we're down to two. With, at least in the Democratic primary, I saw, as a matter of fact, on the Republican primary, there are actually four candidates, three along with President Trump.
Wow.
Which is interesting.
It is.
Yes.
Unexpected.
It is unexpected. But let's focus, if we can, on the two that are remaining in the Democratic Party. Virtually on either end of the polar screen with this thing, is that correct?
Well, while they're both Democrats, you would generally assume that they both support the legalization of marijuana, because that's been a long-held Democratic virtue, let's say. But actually, Bernie, out of the two, is really the one that has the more rational and reasonable drug policies. He has made social justice reform and the legalization of marijuana a cornerstone of his campaign, and has held that belief solidly for his time in office as a senator and also in the House of Representatives. He really just has a flawless record of pro-legalization support. In the 90s, he co-sponsored several pro-legalization bills, and this was way before it was popular or cool to do so. Mm-hmm. And then as a senator, he continued to support pro-legalization bills such as the MORE Act and the Safe Banking Act. And the States Act right now. And he was really the first mainstream presidential candidate that's from one of the two main parties to express support for legalization.
Very good. On a state level, because obviously we have a lot of politics going on here as well, Sheldon, and you're covering this for Folio Weekly, where have you found our local candidates, and where do you find how the public in general feels about that in our community?
Well, it's an interesting thing with these two Democrats who we have left. I'd say, first of all, the fact that we're not going to have legalization on the November ballot is going to undermine efforts to get a strong liberal turnout here in the state of Florida. Of course, it went, Northeast Florida went blue for Gillum back in 2018, but this is a battleground state, and the fact that it's not on the ballot is really going to affect that. Now, as far as the candidates, most of the Democratic Party, most activists, most of the rank and file are in favor of decriminalization or legalization. As Sally said, Senator Sanders, as on this issue, as with most others, is further to the left than any major party candidate perhaps ever. And whereas Joe Biden, he's giving lip service to the decriminalization idea, but he... In his own career, he really represents sort of the what had prevailed is like the bipartisan establishment consensus for most of the past 100 years. He supported the 1994 crime bill, which did a lot to increase mandatory minimum sentences for possession. And, hundreds of thousands of people, were denied the right to vote because of possession felonies and things like that, which is one reason, number one, that Democrats find themselves a little bit behind the eight ball in some key areas as they try to turn out the vote against, of course, Trump's people they're always out there. They're going to have very high turnout. On Super Tuesday, we had 13% turnout, I believe, among voters under 30. And if that trend prevails, then Democrats are going to get taken to the woodshed on every level of the ballot.
If I'm not mistaken, I think I heard in a summary about Super Tuesday, there were actually fewer voters under 30 for the 2020 race than there were 2016. There was actually more of a younger turnout during 2016's races than this year.
That would make sense. You know, normally it doesn't go that way, but it's one of those things. You know, the Sanders people say that the party is rigging the election against them and all that, but he was basically the front runner for the better part of a year. You know, Biden was dead in the water until President Trump sort of, you know, defibrillated his campaign with that Ukraine situation, and he didn't have the people out there behind him. But if the number of people who support Sanders openly online, had they gone out and voted in those same type of numbers on Super Tuesday, this election, this primary would already be over. Now, with Sanders, if Sanders became president, he'd be more likely to possibly put through some changes through executive action, whereas Joe Biden would wait for probably for the legislative branch to send something to his desk. But with Republicans in control of the Senate right now, no legislation is going to get through. So if, and presuming that they don't take the Senate back this year, a Democratic president would have to go through through some type of executive order to clear out convictions or reschedule the drug under narcotics laws.
Sally, I think Shelton's correct when he was talking about the Senate and how the Senate would view any legislation coming through. But from what I understand, the head of that ticket, President Trump, actually has a different position on cannabis than does the Republican-dominated Senate, if you can use that as a general term.
Yeah, people can say what they want about Trump, but when it comes to marijuana legalization, he was not the he didn't kill the program as we thought he would. I mean, my office in Colorado, when Trump was elected, there was a lot of tears. We thought we are out of a job. We thought all the work that we had done pressing marijuana legalization was going to be halted. It was a very dark day, let's say, but you know, the sky did not fall. He kept things pretty much kept the status quo. However, you know, Jeff Sessions in January 2018 did rescind the Cole memo, and the Cole memo was an internal Justice Department policy memorandum that said as long as states who had regulated programs supported 8 federal enforcement priorities, like keeping marijuana out of the hands of children, keeping marijuana not growing on federal lands, not letting this firearms be traded for marijuana and things like that, then they would keep a hands-off approach. They would have marijuana be on the low enforcement priority. And when Jeff Sessions rescinded that, we thought, okay, Trump hasn't done anything yet, but here he goes. Here, it's going to get shut down. No. Well, investment did dry up a little bit because people were scared. But again, nothing really happened because that Cole memo wasn't really law. It was just an internal policy. And since then, the Cole memo has been kept intact pretty much on the policy side of things. It has been a low enforcement priority. Now, the federal government can come at any time and shut us down. They could send out letters saying, you know, cease and desist letters saying we would convict you under federal law if you don't shut down, which would really shut everyone down effectively. But they haven't done that. And Trump hasn't really made it a priority to do so. In general, while his inconsistency on the issue is troublesome and it really makes it difficult for investors to understand what to do and for business owners to have that surety if they can move forward, he hasn't shut us down. And he does, as well as Biden and as well as Bernie, they all three really believe that the states have the right to manage their own policies with regard to marijuana. And I think that's key. You know, on that key issue, they're all three really the same.
Mm-hmm. One thing that, as you were speaking about the two Democratic candidates and Trump and the similarities and obviously those that disagree, the disagreements between the two, is that I can imagine that if there is a debate after the primaries are over and we have our two candidates from the two parties, if they get on stage and the issue of marijuana comes up, are we going to hear more in common if it's then Bernie and Donald than it would be if it were Joe and Donald?
Honestly, I think there'll be a lot of from Trump, I feel like he would divert the issue away, because really he's just going to go back to states' rights every time. You know, he's going to go states' rights. This isn't a federal issue. And that's unfortunate, because it should be a federal issue, because it should be descheduled and it should be legalized. With Bernie, he's going to take a proactive approach. And say, you know, like he's saying right now, in all 50 states, I'm going to legalize it first day. You know, there's a lot of, we can talk about the problems with that he mm-hmm. could not do that effectively. You can't do that through an executive order. Through executive branch, you'd have to go through the Secretary of Department of Health and the Attorney General, and then finally through the FDA to really get that done through the executive branch. But I think it'd really be how they're going to do it. Trump's more of a hands-off guy. But at the end, Bernie would, I think, be the candidate that would actually legalize it at the federal level, which is the goal.
If he could get it through Congress.
If he could get it, yeah.
If he could get it through Congress. Yeah, Sheldon?
Well, I'm not a gambling man, per se. Years of being a Jaguar fan has put me off of that. But I will say, in my opinion, I don't think the subject of marijuana will be raised again in this election, not in the primary debates and certainly not in the general debate. Now, President Trump has a famously hard-edged relationship with alcohol and drugs, particularly alcohol. You know, his older brother, Fred, was a pilot who he really looked up to, and his life was cut short in large part because of alcoholism. So he really feels strongly about that, as he does about the opiates situation. But then at the same time, talking about marijuana, the man, he was in the basement at Studio 454. He was in the tunnels at Danceteria. Mike Tyson used to crash at his house in the early days when he was promoting. And, you know, his base now is comprised largely of hardline far-right conservatives. But prior to his running for president, the life he led was really more consistent with a libertarian approach. And, of course, he was a registered Democrat for a large portion of his life.
You mentioned, Sally, that the president would probably say that this is a state issue and not a federal issue. However, there is one part of the federal government which is very important in this. And I think states that have already legalized recreational marijuana have already experienced it. And that is the banking system itself, mm-hmm. which is federally run.
Yep.
And at this point, because it is a federal crime to derive funding from an illegal sale of marijuana or any other drug, classified drug, they can't make deposits in the banks. So if that is going to change, and if the president maintains that this is going to be a states' rights issue, then how is that going to be impacting the banks across the country and whether or not they can do business even in those states that have legalized marijuana for recreational use?
Well, there was a FinCEN memo that came out back in 2013 or 2014 that said banks can take deposits. However, they have to do a ridiculous amount of due diligence, and the internal compliance these banks would have to do to be able to make sure that these the banks that they're working with are in compliance with the Cole memo and in state compliance with all the multitude of regulations they would have to be in compliance with. These banks are like, it's not worth it, you know. So there is actually an avenue that banks could take to do it. They're just not going to, because it's the overhead. They have enough business. There are some state banks doing it. The idea that there are no banks working with marijuana industries is kind of a myth. There certainly are. It's still a problem. They're not lending, for sure. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, my husband and I had a problem getting a loan on our house just because he's in the marijuana industry. That just even affects me personally. So that is an issue with lending. But there are some banks taking deposits. Now, it is a security issue, too, because if you're running these businesses with cash and the public knows that there's so much cash in a cultivation or in a retail dispensary, that's going to make them a target. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there's some strong rhetoric around this issue, saying if Congress doesn't take action on the Safe Banking Act, that they're literally, you know, pulling the trigger. I mean, that's been some of the really strong rhetoric around this, because there are people getting hurt around these this issue.
I'd like to find out how our listeners feel about this and whether or not it has an impact at all on their decision to either vote for one of the two candidates in the Republican or a Democratic Party, or how it would impact them in a general election with whomever wins the Democratic nomination. Our telephone number is 549-2937. If you'd like to give us a call, lines are open, and we'll be happy to put you on the air with any questions you have or comments, once again, on how you feel about it and how important it is to you as far as this election cycle is concerned. You had made a point, Shelton, that your opinion is that it really isn't going to be that much of a deal, and we're not going to see it raised that much in the general election.
Yes, because everyone pretty much knows how everyone stands on it. The president has said, he's said a couple of times on the record that if a legalization or a decriminalization bill was put on his desk, he would strongly consider signing it. Now, maybe that's something he said knowing that he has the cover of a Republican-controlled Senate, so nothing would come before him. Mm-hmm. They all agree that it's a states' rights issue, but as the conservatives found out a long time ago, federal mandates trump states' rights every day on every single issue. And when it comes to, you know, whether it's the FDIC, Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FBI, or the ATF, these businesses, they, in a state like Florida or many other states, it's legal. It's, you know, legal for them to do business, but the feds can always come in and, you know, interfere if they want to. Now, thankfully, there hasn't been much of that, but I've heard stories of Canadian businessmen being denied entry, you know, coming across the border for marijuana conferences. That happened sometime last year. And, you know, you can put your money in the banks if you're a dispensary or whatever. You know, you can go through the banks as you have to do, but that money can be frozen and seized at any time and for any reason. And when you're dealing in a product like that, you know, the federal law treats it essentially the same way they treat the cartels, except they're actually, you know, the cartels have a lot more money in the banking system right now than the legal marijuana dealers. But as we expand on this market, the market in Florida potentially could grow as high as a billion if this stuff ever gets legalized here. As it progresses, I don't think it's going to be mentioned this year because no one really has a reason to do so. Biden can talk about it, but they'll say to Biden, well, everything you've ever done as a senator, you know, suggests that you're just, you know, giving lip service to the issue. Barack Obama openly called for the legalization of marijuana as a candidate, but then as president, he had both houses of Congress and the presidency, you know, and nothing was done on the issue. Trump has the odd advantage of saying, even though it's not really his doing, more strides have been made on the cannabis issue under his presidency than under every one of the previous presidents combined.
Let's move our attention to the state of Florida as far as marijuana is concerned. As most of us know, when medical marijuana was the issue, it was a bottom-up type of program. It was basically voter connected, and the voters are the ones that came up with the petition signatures in order to get it on the ballot. The legislature wouldn't do it. Now we're past that point, and we're into a question about legalized recreational marijuana. And I know that the petitions that they had been circulating for the last couple of years fell short, so it won't be on the 2020 ballot, but I guess those that were instrumental in trying to get this organized in the first place are now looking towards 2022. Why didn't it make it, besides the signatures, why didn't it make it as far as an issue for the legislature itself to address? Start it, Sally.
There's probably a multifaceted answer to that, but I would start with marijuana is just really not a top priority for the Florida legislature. And they have this nice little lawsuit called FloraGrown that's pending right now. Oral arguments for that will be in April. And so what that is, there's a marijuana statute, and this group FloraGrown decided to sue the Department of Health, stating that the statute was unconstitutional on two grounds. Number one, that the cap on medical marijuana treatment center licenses in the state of Florida was unconstitutional. There should not be a cap at the state level. And second of all, they said that the required vertical integration is unconstitutional. And the lower court and the first DCA agreed with FloraGrown. FloraGrown won at both those levels. They and it is now actually the Supreme Court has agreed to take it on. And as I said, it's going to be in April. It's going to get kicked off. I think the Florida legislature has a nice little excuse right now to say, we're not going to deal with this, okay, because it's going to be dealt with by the courts. And that's a better avenue for it to be dealt with right now.
We have a couple of phone calls. Let's take them, and then we'll get back to this topic as well. Chris in Avondale, good morning. You're on First Coast Connect. Let's see if I got it there. Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Thank you. Good morning.
I'm curious that I'm hearing a lot of politic talk about this, about which side wants what and which side doesn't want. I'm not hearing any pros and cons from anyone. Why are we pro marijuana and why are we con marijuana?
Okay.
I think that the pro views are probably taxes and the money that states could make from it, but I'm not hearing a lot about the cons. We still have many drunk drivers here in town. We still have many things of that. Where are they standing on these pros and cons?
Okay, thank you, Chris, very much. Appreciate the call. And how did other states sell it to their constituencies in order to get it passed, or for those that have defeated it, what arguments did they use to defeat it?
Well, you know, getting to the pros and cons, from my personal perspective, the pro position is that I write about it for a living, so it's good for my business. The con side is that I have to get up early in the morning to talk about it on the radio. It's been sold, you know, around the country. Now, back in the 90s, a number of states passed decriminalization or outright legalization bills on the state level through ballot initiatives. And then in 2001, under Attorney General John Ashcroft and President George W. Bush, the Supreme Court basically swept all that off the table, so they had to come back around and do it again. As far as the pros, people are talking about, say in the state of Florida, that this issue is driven largely by the veterans community and our huge seniors community. Pain relief, stress relief, you know, anti-inflammatory, things like that. The cons, you know, it relates to a lot of old stereotypes and reefer madness type stuff that's been largely disproven. As it relates to Florida, you look at the numbers coming out of California, out of Washington State, out of Colorado, arrests being down, violent crime being down, revenue being through the roof, tax revenue being through the roof. It's a win-win proposition kind of across the board. Now, we were talking about, you were asking about the legalization amendment.
Yes.
Sally is a much kinder, gentler human being than I am. In my opinion, the reason that the legalization thing did not get on the ballot is because the industry tanked it on purpose. It went down because of greed, because of personal issues among like higher ups in that industry that have nothing to do with the policy. They had it right there. 67% of Floridians were in favor of it. All they had to do was get it on the ballot and it would have passed easily, just like Amendment 2 did a couple of years ago. And it would have brought a lot more liberal voters out to the polls as well. But they split their initiative. They spent millions of dollars. I don't know where that money went. It didn't go into getting legislation through. It didn't go into getting this on the ballot. And, you know, they're talking about 2022, trying to get it on the ballot. The fact that it's not on the ballot this year means any chance, you know, in 2017, 2018, everyone was holding hands. They were kumbaya. You know, even the conservatives were giving, you know, a little lip service to the idea of decriminalization. Ron DeSantis was, you know, pretty open to it, letting Nikki Free kind of have her way with the situation. But It's 2020. It's an election year and the good vibes are gone. Now, not having it on the ballot means that you're going to have a lot fewer liberal voters at the polls, which means any hope of Democrats taking the Florida House or the Florida Senate are really kind of out the door. So they're talking about, oh, we're going to take these signatures and hold them back until 2022. I would be surprised if we ever hear about this again. Now, someone will try, but they had it right there and they blew it. You know, we openly said that they were going to blow it. As soon as they split their effort, it was known that it was going in that direction. And so I would like to trust them to do the right thing and get it done next time. I mean, there's $1 billion potentially at stake in revenue for businesses up and down the state, but there's no way of knowing.
For Amendment 2, I think the most familiar face of proposing the amendment was John Morgan, the attorney John Morgan. I've not heard much from him in the second generation of marijuana legalization. Was he active in this recreational side of it?
Yeah, lots of memes, lots of funny little videos on the internet, and certainly I believe he put some money into some of these legalization efforts that have happened, you know, but I mean, my lawyer advises me to say that he's a wonderful guy and his motives are entirely pure, but the fact is, on this issue, as with a lot of things on the liberal side in the state, the Democratic Party does not have a leadership. You know, this issue has no leadership. If John Morgan had wanted this to pass, if the industry, with the millions and millions of dollars that they put in, if they wanted this to pass, it would have passed. There was no reason that they could not have gotten 763,000 signatures in a state of 20 million people with 6 months to get it done.
You know, very interesting.
I would like to ask John Morgan exactly what's going on and how he feels about it, but he doesn't return my calls.
Nor would I think you call into our program this morning either.
He's listening.
But
I'm
everybody
sure
else
listening.
Everybody else is invited to call, and so is Mr. Morgan for that matter. Our telephone number is 549-2937. We have a couple of minutes left. There's a technical issue that's associated with this whole program, which I understand has been contentious, and that's the vertical integration issue. And for explanation purposes, and Sally, you can probably do this a lot better than I can, but basically it's a question from growing to selling and one commodity owning the entire process, correct?
Absolutely. You can states decide whether or not they're going to allow horizontal or vertical integration for marijuana companies. And that means, can I, as a business owner, go out and get one license to just cultivate, or I can get a license to just dispense? Certain states allow you to do both, but Florida requires you to do everything. So that's a different, there are a lot of states that have vertical integration. Colorado has vertical. They don't require it though. So you're allowed to go get a processor, a cultivation, a dispenser license in Colorado. In Florida, you're forced to. And that makes it very expensive. Me as an individual, if I wanted to own a marijuana business, I might have just the amount of money to go get a lease on a property and open up a dispensary, right? I do not have the millions and millions of dollars it would take to run a cultivation and a dispensary and own the processing and the equipment and the transporting and the advertising. Like, you can't contract to any third party for any service related to cultivation, dispensing, or processing in the state of Florida. Yeah. And that makes these very expensive, and it cuts out the mom and pops entirely.
And the large corporations that are basically controlling the market now, the ones that can afford to thrive in the vertical integration model, they have no particular interest in competition. A big part of the schism on the legalization amendment was on the issue of home grow. A lot of these companies thought that allowing citizens to grow their own marijuana would cut into their profits somehow. You can brew your own beer legally. That's not cutting business for the craft breweries. So, you know, Governor DeSantis was openly opposed to the vertical integration model, and he'd made noises about doing something about it. Nikki Fried made noises about doing something about it, but that sort of slowed down. And I find it, I'd like to know why exactly they kind of dropped it.
Okay, we have a few calls in, so let's go to our calls. Tom on the West Side, good morning. You're on First Coast Connect.
Okay, good morning to y'all too. And I had a question and an observation.
Sure.
The question was, do y'all think that the legislature's act on citizen initiatives is in any way related to slowing marijuana referendums in the future? And also the observation I think that we may be overlooking is the last city budget committed 40% of its budget to law enforcement. And I think if we legalize marijuana, we could probably do a lot better than that. So that's my thoughts, and I'd like to hear your answer on that question.
Okay. Well, speaking of law enforcement, there's an organization called LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, organization comprised of former police officers, former sheriffs from up and down the state who are in favor of decriminalization. I can't say for sure. No one's taken a poll, but I've never met a cop in my life that was opposed to the legalization of marijuana. You know, the idea is that It will cut down on, and we've seen across the country, like, that's part of the argument that's been made. A lot of these cities and states that have made efforts to scale back the drug war have done so with the consent and the enthusiastic support of law enforcement, because it reduces, it allows them to put man hours and resources into major crimes like cybercrime, mm-hmm. human trafficking, things like that. So I don't think that the idea that the police are necessarily, of course, it's their job to enforce the law as is, but they've really taken no open stand on this issue one way or another. The conservatives who might be opposed to legalization, again, getting back to this amendment, the people that are opposed to it, they don't have to do anything. The failure of the legalization amendment to make the ballot had nothing to do with any opposition or pushback on the part of the conservatives. This was entirely a matter of liberals not being able to get along with each other, not being able to get on the same page, and they just simply dropped the ball.
Okay, Tom, thank you very much for your call. We appreciate it. Next up is Bill, who's calling us from Fleming Island. Good morning, Bill. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Yeah, it's not really good here. We're kind of far out here.
But no, you're good.
It doesn't surprise me that people who do drugs want to do more drugs, and that there will be people who will help them get more drugs. And I don't know, I try to equate the whole idea, if someone gave me a car, I bought a car, it's the only car I'm going to have for my life, you know, I'd take care of that car like unbelievable. It would be unbelievable, you know, I'd just read the manual 10 times, make sure she's waxed, filled up, whatever. But your mind is just like that. And what you're saying is that doing drugs, alcohol, to excess, or even in a mild way when you're doing more than one together, that enhances the experience, and that's a good thing. But it really isn't. Everybody knows that. So I don't really catch I don't see the argument. I know your guy makes every kind of argument he can possibly make about it, but that's just a guy being paid to tell you what he wants you to hear. But I don't believe that if you look at really at the individual cases, I mean, it's bad news, but I'll take your comments off the air.
Okay. Thank you very much for the call.
So I hear you and I understand your concern. However, marijuana has scientifically been proven to be less harmful and safer for you than alcohol and tobacco. Both of those substances are regulated by the government and taxed. And if you are really concerned that marijuana is bad for you, do you want the people to be in control of that to be criminals? Or would you prefer them to be the government? If you have the government in control of this substances that you think is dangerous, I do not believe, but if you have them in control, they will test it. They will card your children to make sure that they're not having access to it. Now, compare that to the guy on the corner who's selling marijuana. He doesn't care how old your kid is. He is not testing it. He's putting pesticides on it. So the argument is not whether really is marijuana the best thing to put in your body. The argument is marijuana is going to be out there. And whether or not you believe it has medical benefit is irrelevant. It's going to be out there. Let's make sure it's given to people in a safe manner. And let's make sure it's taxed. And we put those taxes towards the benefit of the greater good.
Okay, just a minute left here.
And I'd just like to point out in response to one thing the caller said, I've written 122 of these cannabis columns for Folio Weekly, and we've done probably a dozen, maybe two dozen of these segments on WJCT, and at no point ever have I ventured a personal opinion on how I feel about the legalization of cannabis one way or another. I'm happy for you guys to keep on arguing about it because that's more stuff to write. Now, as far as the argument to be made, you know, for it or against it, you know, I'll stand with my friends in the veterans community, you know, people that have served overseas, people from our greatest generation that were in World War II that have it now. Something about like 60% of the people with medical cards now are people over the age of 50. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have a card.
Okay. Wish we had more time to take calls, but unfortunately we don't. However, I do know that Shelton's got a column coming out on Wednesday. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Want to give us a little preview on that?
Sure. The column coming out on Wednesday is about a company, Maku, out of Gainesville, one of many companies doing CBD-type products. And there's new companies every day. And almost every day. The column that's out right now is about the Sweetwater Brewing Company up in Atlanta. They got into the hard seltzer business with little terpenes giving a sort of smell and flavor. It's pretty cute.
Very good. Sally, thank you very much for being with us. Shelton, thank you for with us, and we appreciate the phone calls that came in as well.
Thank you for having us.
Up next, how NAMI Jacksonville, Florida is helping break down the barriers and stigmas surrounding mental health here in Northeast Florida. We'll be right back.
WJCT invites you to join us for an evening with Ari Shapiro on Thursday, April 2nd, award-winning journalist and weekday co-host of All Things Considered, NPR's award-winning afternoon news program, will join WJCT's president and CEO, David McGowan, for an engaging conversation. Visit wjct.org/events for ticket information. Sponsored by the Community Foundation for Northeast Florida. Take a drive with us into the blues horizon. The best in classic and modern blues. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. Right here on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. The National Alliance on Mental Health Jacksonville, Florida, or NAMI, recently hired its first ever executive director. And her name is Suzanne Melou, and she joins us here in the studio to discuss the organization's efforts to support and improve the quality of life for individuals living with mental illness. Very nice to have you with us, Suzanne. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mike.
Tell us a little bit about NAMI and what you people are all about.
Yes, great. So NAMI Jacksonville is a nonprofit organization. We are the local affiliate of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. We've been around since 1987, serving our community in Clay and Duval County. NAMI, the national organization, is the largest grassroots mental health organization and started in 1979. There is currently 48 state organizations and over 600 local affiliates. What we do is we serve our community for people who are living with mental illness. We're here to support and improve the quality of life for family members and those individuals living with mental illness and co-occurring substance abuse through compassion, education, and advocacy.
The actual work that NAMI does, is this more of a clearinghouse for people that have questions on it and don't know where to go in order to get the help itself?
We actually have local programs. We have many programs that are free. All of our programs are free. So we have support groups. We have education classes. We have presentations to our community. So we actually support individuals who are living with mental health conditions and family members who have loved ones who are living with mental health conditions. We have support groups in both Clay and Duval counties. We have a peer-to-peer class and a family-to-family class. We teach people how to communicate with their loved ones. We teach individuals how to cope with mental illness, where to find resources as well in our community. But we have direct programming for our individuals and family members.
Do we have a handle on how large a problem this really is in our community?
Yes, unfortunately, a lot of people don't want to talk about mental health conditions. There's a lot of stigma surrounding it, which in the end prevents people from seeking the help that they need. But one in five adults will have a mental health condition this year in the United States. One in 25 adults experience serious mental health conditions, and 17% of our youth have mental health experiences as well.
Many of us go to our family physician, general practitioner, once a year for some testing and also just as a mental checkup, if you were not a mental checkup, but that was my point. When I go to my doctor never asked me, so how do you feel these days? You know, just trying to get into my head a little bit to see where I am. So where are those who may be suffering from a mental disorder or a mental illness? Where do they find out if in fact it is? since they don't get that generally from their family physician unless someone brings it to their attention and then they help.
Yes, and I think that's part of the problem is once we start talking about it, you see that there are many, many people, your brother, your sister, your parents, or a son or a daughter who have mental health issues. So when we begin to start talking about it, it brings more awareness and you realize that, well, maybe this is a mental health condition, maybe isn't just a typical I'm feeling low today, and there are avenues to seek help. And so once we start talking about, once we have the conversation about it, you can go to your physician who will then refer you. But NAMI Jacksonville also has helplines. We have a helpline that you can call us and you can talk to us. We'll help refer you to resources. Our helpline we have by telephone or by email. The phone number is 904-724-7782, or you can reach us at NAMIJacksonvilleFL@gmail.com. And those are some helplines that you can talk to us and we can help find resources for you and talk to you and lead you to some help. We also have been working with Duval County Public Schools. They have been incredible. Their behavioral help team has been incredible in helping get the word out. NAMI National has a program that we put out called Ending the Silence. It's for middle and high school students. And the idea of that is to let kids know that they are not alone, that it's okay to talk about mental health conditions, and it teaches them to seek help early. Which leads to better treatment and better recovery. And it teaches their friends how to be a good friend if they identify something that they see is just not right. So this program is a program that we're putting out to Duval County Public Schools, middle and high schools in our county. And it's been an incredible program to really just begin the conversation.
Do you work closely with law enforcement as far as for counseling for those who have been convicted of crimes or in helping determine whether or not a crime was committed with somebody who had a mental illness? Is that part of your mission?
Yeah, in part. What we do with JSO is NAMI does not ourselves put on this program, but we definitely support CIT training, which is crisis intervention training for our law enforcement officers. And Duval County has had that training for all of their officers. And it is a way for them to identify before you arrest somebody or before they find somebody who has committed a crime, is this truly a mental health issue or is it truly a criminal issue? And it really does help support the officers. And the officers then support our public who might find a better avenue for that person who is experiencing a mental health condition.
Is it generally thought that if we did have better mental health work going on and people would go to physicians to get more information and to be treated for it, that we would see a lower crime rate in our community?
Absolutely. A lot of people are just arrested because there's a misunderstanding there. But the earlier we seek help, the less chance you are to be confronted by an officer for a crime. There is an 11-year onset from the original beginnings of mental health issues that you see to seeking treatment. So many people wait 11 years before they seek treatment. And at that point, a lot of things can happen that cause you to do things that you wouldn't otherwise.
Very good. In the moment we have left, would you give once again the contact information for NAMI? And by the way, that's spelled N-A-M-I for people who may not be able to.
That's right. That's right. You can go to our website. It's N-A-M-I, NAMI, JacksonvilleFL.org. So we invite you to go there and see what we're doing and come out to our community meetings.
Okay. Thank you very much, Suzanne, for being with us. Nice to have you here.
Yeah, thanks, Mike.
You bet. Up next, Cole Pepper with a preview of all the action that will be going on this week at the Players' Championship.
ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington Jacksonville East remind you to act fast, whether it's water, mold, or fire damage. ServPro of Jacksonville South and Arlington Jacksonville East, 721-2230. Like it never even happened.
Farrah and Farrah, dedicated to representing the injured people in Jacksonville for over 40 years. Learn more at farrahandfarrah.com or 396-5555. Farrah and Farrah's accident attorneys are here for you, here for good.
Archaeologists have recently completed the final excavation before development takes over at Bradenton's Mineral Springs Park, site of the Free Black Settlement of Angola. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, will also discuss the development of tourism in Panama City Beach and the African-American community in Apopka. That's Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
The U.S. and the United Kingdom are developed economies, yes, but they have both got real high levels of income inequality.
A long history of blaming and shaming poor people going way back centuries, but the U.S. and the U.K. are kind of past masters at it.
I'm Kai Rizdal, Poverty, Policy, and Shame. Next time on Marketplace.
Today at 6 on 89.9 WJCT.
Women's traditional roles in Africa have been upended by what's become known as the missing men. Thousands of men have left to find work in Europe, and most of the men never return. It's a social and economic revolution chronicled by Dion Searcy, former New York Times West Africa bureau chief, in a new memoir, In Search of Disobedient Women. Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT. Culpepper Sports Wrap-Up is brought to you by Farrah and Farrah.
Welcome back. And yes, this is the time for Culpepper to join us here in First Coast Connect. It's Players Week. Many of the players came in last night. They're going to be out at the driving range, I guess, today. And then all the action actually begins on Thursday, correct? Good morning, Cole. Good to see you, by the way. I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper.
Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too? Great to see you, Mike.
Thank you.
As we were joking, is it old-timey radio reunion here?
I feel like that.
Well, listen, some of the players rolled in last night. Phil Mickelson was doing some night work with the lights on at 17 last night to try to get ready. A lot of them will be coming in today for either the range, the practice rounds, whatnot. Tomorrow is the first time that the public can get out on the course and watch the practice rounds. Remember that this year, different than in past years, you must have a ticket for each and every day. You must also have a parking pass for each and every day. You can purchase the parking on the players' website, theplayers.com. As for the competition, it's become an annual tradition that I make my pick on this show. So here's who I'm looking at this week.
Drum roll,
to
please.
Win. Right. So certainly Rory McIlroy has to be considered the defending champ, the world's number one ranked player. Nobody has ever repeated, though, as the players' champion. Tiger Woods is not in the field. His back is giving him issues, so I better not pick him. I will consider John Rahm. He's been in contention here before. He's ranked number two in the world right now. Now, you have to hit it straight on this course. Jim Furyk hits it straight. The Ponte Vedra Beach resident finished second to McIlroy last year, and he's leading the tour in driving accuracy. This just feels like a tournament he should win at some point. By the way, he announced that he will be the host for a Champions Tour event that will be held at Timaquana Country Club in the future, so that'll be a regular thing. So I'm not sure about his focus this week. If it's pulled in different directions, we'll see how it plays out. You have to be accurate on your approach shots to win. Webb Simpson won 2 years ago. He's in the top 10 in accuracy. He needs to be considered. And finally, you have to know when to take your shot, Mike. There are some risk-reward holes on this course, and nobody is better at that than U.S. Open champ Gary Woodland.
You also explain. I'm sorry, Cole. Explain what that means.
So whether you're talking about a par 5, whether that's number 2, number 9, number 11, number 16, maybe on number 12 that's a drivable par 4, do you decide to go for it, try to get on, go for eagle at some point? But there are risks in all of these holes in going for it. So coming down, whether it's the final round or whether it's the first round, there's going to be a time where the decision to be made has to be whether you're going to go for it or play a little safe and maybe, you know, leave birdie in play, but certainly leave par as a possibility. You have to make up your mind on how to do that. And this tour actually keeps a stat called going for it. And Gary Woodland is number one at that stat this year, following up on his U.S. Open win a year ago. So somebody to watch there. Although big bombers don't often do well here, and he is a big hitter of the ball off the tee. You need to be steady. You need to be accurate and a little daring. And that's why I'm picking Rory McIlroy to become the first man to repeat as players' champion. We'll see how it plays out on Sunday.
You've played the course.
I have.
Tell me about it from your perspective.
It's hard. listen, the course is set up for the players' championship differently than it is the rest of the year. Mm-hmm. the move to May had it playing as firm and fast. So they wanted the ball to run through the fairway into the rough. This is in March is really the way that this course was designed to be played in these conditions. The wind becomes a major factor here, particularly on holes that have water. Yeah. 17 comes right to mind, and the impact that that wind can have. If the wind's coming off the ocean, that creates a real issue for golfers in terms of club selection and so forth. So we'll see how that all plays out. But it's a tough course, and it is a course that really demands every club in your bag be used and used well. This is not one where you can just outdrive the course or that you leave the driver in the bag and just hit 3-iron off the tee. This is an every club in your bag kind of course.
Where would you put the Players' Championship in difficulty from all of the others on the tour?
Well, remember that if you start talking about the majors, the only major that's played on the same course is the Masters. And I think this is a slightly more difficult course than the Masters, although the pressure of the Masters can be greater in some regard. The greens are certainly faster typically at the Masters. U.S. Open courses are set up much more difficult. I will say the last 2 weeks on the tour, the scoring has been very tough at both the Honda and Bay Hill here in the state of Florida.
Yeah, yesterday was brutal.
Only four players finished under par yesterday at Bay Hill. So I think you'll see more than four players under par. It is set up so, in my mind, something around 8 to 10 under should win this tournament most years.
Very good. It would be good to see what happens. They're doing a lot for the spectators again this year.
As always, they've changed a bit, tweaked it. The big thing is about making sure you have your tickets and your parking. Those tickets, by the way, are all digital tickets this year, so you have to have them on your phone.
Okay. Cole, thank you very much.
Thanks, Mike.
We'll see you out there. First Coast Connect, by the way, will be broadcasting live from the Players' Championship this coming Thursday morning. So be listening there, or if you're out there, come on by and say hello. I want to appreciate everybody coming in to us. We have a lot that we've been going through. We appreciate everybody who's been with us this morning, those of you who've called, those of you who've come into the studio. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is our director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo and Bill Bortsfield. He's our digital editor. If you have questions or comments about First Coast Connect, send an email to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. If you missed anything of the morning show, you can hear it rebroadcast tonight at 8 on 89.9. With that, I'm Mike Miller sitting in for Melissa Ross. You're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. I'll be back again tomorrow morning at 9. We hope to connect with you again.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.